How are you? Welcome to Socialism 2019. Yes. Trump's dictator parade got rained on, at least partially, so there's some justice in the world. Russell Rickford and I were discussing before this panel, this is a quite auspicious moment. There's a lot of anniversaries landing right around now. We have the 400th anniversary approaching of us being brought here. We have the 50th anniversary of some of the biggest social struggles in this country, a wave of those anniversaries that have been happening since last year. And it's also the 4th of July. An anniversary that I think has, for a lot of us, it's at a time to reflect on the meaning of this country and what the flag represents and what the country represents. And often I know for myself and some of my comrades in the room, we often think back to Frederick Douglass's famous speech that he gave in Rochester one 4th of July, posing the question, what to the slave is the 4th of July? And similarly, we could probably ask today, what to the caged migrant child is the 4th of July? But anyway, we're here to talk about education, black radical struggle, radical imagination. My name is Brian Jones. I'm an educator and activist in New York City, and I'm joined here with Russell Rickford. Can you all hear me?
Yeah.
Okay.
Very well.
Awesome. Russell Rickford, who teaches history at Cornell University and is the author of many books, but most recently this one, We Are an African People: Independent Education, Black Power, and the Radical Imagination. And so what we're going to do tonight is have a discussion for about 45 minutes, talk about many of these topics really in three domains. One is the kind of broad connection between education and social change in our history. Secondly, the stories from this book about the independent black radical schools of the 1970s that Professor Rickford has done research on and has a lot of stories to tell here that are important. And lastly, something about the education, the landscape of political and black radical educational activism today. How many people in the room are educators of some form? Wow. Okay, very good. Excellent. How many people in the room are students in some form or another? Awesome. Okay. And everybody else, welcome. You're welcome too. So let's get started. I think the first thing is just the big picture. Like, black people get a bad rap for not caring about education, but arguably the opposite is true, that black people have been focused on education more than anybody else in this country. How can we describe the role of education in black history in this country?
Yeah, thanks. You know, so one of the things we were talking about earlier is the idea that black folks of all the different groups in American history, maybe among the groups that have been too enthusiastic, too hopeful, too optimistic about the possibilities of education, about the transformative possibilities of education. I'm reminded there's a black radical, Doxie Wilkerson, that said something like, I don't want to butcher this quote, but he said something like, it's not the education of black people that will bring about their liberation. It's the liberation of black people that will bring about proper education.
Well, yeah, page 62.
There you go. I think one of the things that's interesting to me and that motivated in part this book is this kind of paradox in terms of African-American philosophies of education or conceptions of education, a purpose of education, right? I think there's been a long history of black folks seeing education, educational struggles, pedagogy as a means of gaining fuller inclusion in the existing society, right? And in democratizing the society, sort of education for social inclusion. And at the same time, there's been this other impulse of education as a means of self-definition and as a means of self-identity, ultimately as a means of self-determination. And I think those are, I mean, in some ways they're dueling impulses. In many ways they form a dialectic, and quite frequently we see Black educational struggles are trying to do all of the above at once. And there's sort of various ideological contests that take place within that construct. I mean, I think within the 1960s, the late 60s and 70s, which is the period I focus on in this book, you know, the question again is a sort of reframing of that education as a means, again, of redeeming American society, or in the sort of anti-colonial parlance of the moment, of the time, education as the final battlefield of the colonized, right? And this sort of evocative, romantic, generative idea of the colonial analogy, right? If third world peoples are struggling for independence, self-determination all around the world, what does that mean for the African American struggle? And in fact, we also are trying to resist colonialism, that we also are trying to achieve not just legal equality, but self-determination in some deeper sense.
And for a lot of the, maybe not for all of the thinkers or the kind of leaders or figureheads, but for a lot of the parents who are in these struggles that you describe, there's not always a hard line between these different impulses or these different strategies. It's not like there's a hard line between the separatists and the integrationists, or we could say desegregationists. People do both.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think a good example is the freedom schools of the 60s. You know, particularly the first half of the 60s. The most I think famous freedom schools around Mississippi Freedom Summer '64. And right from the beginning, you see these sort of two currents of Black educational thought. On one hand, clearly, the freedom schools are an attempt to democratize, a deeply undemocratic society. And perhaps the most sort of undemocratic region, right, of the society. So they're an attempt to sort of expose the deep contradictions, limitations of the segregated school system. On the other hand, there's already a critique in 64 in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in SNCC that's saying that we're not just trying to critique the decadent institutions, but we have the potential to replace them.
Yeah.
And of course, the more organizing that happens, the more institutions are created. I mean, you have, for example, even before that, you have Septima Clark and you have the citizenship schools.
Mm-hmm.
You have the freedom schools going back into Garvey's era in the 1920s, the Garvey movement is at its height. The Universal Negro Improvement Association has its schools. The Nation of Islam, coming out of the 1930s in urban areas, have their own schools. The more of these models that are created in connection with various waves of the Black freedom struggle, the more there's a realization that that Black folk actually have the capacity to not only create independent institutions in terms of learning and teaching, but also in terms of modeling new societies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so this very old idea of prefigurative politics that we can create in miniature, the model of the new society within the shell of the old.
Right, right. So it's like if you can't get your needs met battling with the existing institution, you're going to create your own thing. And just to say for people who, and so sometimes people move from one to the other or back and forth, and this book covers a period that otherwise is not really well discussed, which is independent schools. Schools that Black activists made in the 1970s and tried to run, trying to institution build. And doing so in a way, Professor Rickford argues, to try to hold on to the best of the movements that had come in the decades before. These are left-wing schools, These aren't Catholic schools, or you can imagine other kinds of groups who form schools that don't have this same kind of ethos. These are an attempt to build institutions, but in doing so, it's hard to hold on to that movement ethos when you have to pay bills and pay salaries and keep the lights on.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think there is an inherent contradiction. I mean, much of the book is centered around the idea of institution building, the principle of institution building, the value, the quest for creating parallel institutions that can become a kind of infrastructure for a future society.
Yeah.
I mean, these are by and large Black nationalist and Pan-Africanist schools. So quite often the organizing principle of their activism is the sort of is nationhood,
yeah.
Right? Is the ideal of nationhood. That changes and evolves and becomes more complex over the course of the, many of these schools arise in the late 60s, early 70s. There's a radicalization process where people begin to challenge this idea of nationhood, of national identity, of national organization as the sort of central principle of education. I mean, I can talk about that in a second.
Yeah.
One of the alternatives, one of the very evocative alternatives, is the liberated, what I call the liberated territory,
mm-hmm.
rather than the nation as the sort of ultimate goal of education.
So before we get to that, because that's going to take us abroad, which is important, but before we get to that, I think there's a point here about these schools, or rather the way that the schools, and following the educators and the parents who are putting them together and trying to build these institutions, it ends up being a roadmap to the Black left. And part of what you're sorting through in this book, and this is one of the reasons I think it's a very useful book, beyond just the issue of education, is understanding and sorting through and assessing different trends in the Black left. Can you try to explain just the gist of the landscape? Because not all Black nationalists are created equally, not all Pan-Africanists are created equally. There's different trends and different trajectories.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, part of what the book attempts to do is to lay out a taxonomy, typology of the Black nationalism, Pan-Africanism, and to some extent the Black left during this period. I mean, this is a remarkable moment in that, some people would describe it as a post-civil rights era. Really, the early 1970s is in some ways the high point, the heyday of this sort of Black revolution, or at least the phase of the Black revolution that really accelerates earlier in the 1960s. Pan-Africanist consciousness, and I would say also a kind of radical internationalism or third worldism, certainly anti-imperialism, is fairly hegemonic among Black progressives.
Mm.
I mean, among a wide segment of Black progressives and the left. So that becomes a sort of central principle of these schools, but there are a lot of different impulses within that, right? There's what I call a racial Pan-Africanism,
mm-hmm.
And there's what I call a left Pan-Africanism, right? So a racial Pan, they both sort of depart from a premise that Black people around the world are connected,
mm-hmm.
connected politically. They're connected in terms of history, their circumstances, their subjugation is interconnected. Racial Pan-Africanism emphasizes a sort of a kind of a racial essence,
mm-hmm.
That's connecting Black folks and posits that as the sort of central organizing principle. Left Pan-Africanism is much more interested in a materialist analysis of why Black folks in South Africa,
mm-hmm.
and why Black folks in South Carolina, right, are facing some of the same kinds of oppression, colonization, marginalization, economically, socially, culturally, etc. Right, and there's the appearance of a consensus for a moment early in the 1970s. And then there's some very sort of dramatic splits and polarization. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a way of talking about this period in terms of decline, in terms of the splintering of the left, not just the black left, in terms of splintering of 60s movements in general. But I like to think of it not just in terms of degeneration or decline, but in terms of maturation and in terms of evolution. I think there's some very powerful movements, sub-movements perhaps, that come out of this era and come out of those debates. And I think that that work still needs to be done in terms of telling that history.
Can you tell us like one story of one of these schools that goes, I'm thinking like Malcolm X Liberation University is one, that kind of has an arc to it that takes us through some of these different trends? Is there a story from the book that you think illustrates this point?
Yeah. Well, there are a number of stories. I would sort of focus on moments, right? There's one of the moments I would focus on that almost all of these schools, these independent black institutions and their organizers are connected to is the Sixth Pan-African Congress in Tanzania, East Africa in 1974. So this was a highly anticipated event by Pan-Africanists in the United States. The United States delegation to the Sixth Pan-African Congress, or SIXPAC as they called it, was the largest delegation. It was the, in many ways, the most polarized delegation. There were, you know, all kinds of constituencies, you know, Garveyites, black nationalists, Marxist-Leninists, Maoists, etc. But what the delegation encountered at the Sixth Pan-African Congress, well, they encountered a lot of things. Number one, they encountered liberation movements that were dealing with their own internal struggles. Mm. So for example, Angola, you know, MPLA, from the Angola Liberation Movement, Angola was still struggling for independence against Portugal. So the United States Pan-Africanists are now encountering some of the realities, some of the complexities, right? Of the third world of African liberation. At the same time, so that's the liberation movements, at the same time they're dealing with some of the complexities of post-colonialism because they're encountering the rulers of these emerging African and Caribbean states, many of whom are deeply repressive, right?
Give us an example.
Well, okay, so for example, I'm writing a book about Guyana, my own native Guyana. I was born in Guyana, South America. A lot of people don't know about Guyana. If they know anything about Guyana, they know about Jonestown in the 1970s. But Guyana was a former British colony. Ultimately, an Afro-Guyanese by the name of Burnham emerged as the prime minister. Burnham presented himself as both a Pan-Africanist and a sort of very strong proponent of the non-aligned world, African liberation, etc. At the same time that he was consolidating power and that he was, you know, deeply repressive. And so the nation state ideal that the African Americanists took to the Sixth Pan-African Congress very quickly broke down when they realized that Burnham, not only Burnham, but the leader of Trinidad, the leader of these other states, had prevented some of their opposition, their internal opposition, from attending SIXPAC, right? So it flew in the very principle of this kind of sort of global mystique of blackness. There were also other ideological struggles around, you know, African socialism versus more of a scientific, you know, socialism, that kind of thing. But I say that, you know, and then a lot of the African American delegates left Tanzania feeling like the experience had been a failure. But again, ultimately, I think if we trace the long arc of this, it was also a moment of tremendous political evolution, political education, and maturation.
Yeah. So when they came back to the U.S., what did they do differently, or did some of them do differently?
Well, many of them were in the midst of a turn to the far left. I mean, people like Amiri Baraka. Amiri Baraka had been a poet, of course, leader of the and founder of the Congress of African People. He was based in Newark, New Jersey, and he had been one of the most visible and influential
cultural nationalist. Mm-hmm. And he was really a disciple of Maulana Karenga and the US organization out in the West that was basically arguing that in order to free themselves, black people needed to return to these sort of concepts of African tradition.
Yeah.
And that involved, and particularly in the cultural realm, so that involved, you know, speech, you know, traditional African languages. Swahili, for example, was very popular, mm-hmm. African garb, et cetera. Amir Baraka was one of the main proponents of that. In the early to mid-1970s, it makes a hard left shift. And it does so, again, you know, quite often the story of, you know, let's say black power, the story of the left in the late 60s and 70s more broadly is about, you know, sort of dogmatism.
Yeah.
But he does so, he makes this left shift because he collides with the limitations of what I call bourgeois nationalism. Mm. He collides with those limitations in Newark, you know, because Newark now has a black mayor at this point,
right?
So you get this explosion of black elected officials, and of course the material realities for the black rank and file is not improving. If anything, it's getting worse in places like Newark, et cetera. So, you know, a lot of these thinkers start to realize that we need something stronger.
Yeah.
As the Panther said, we need something stronger than these sort of cultural trappings of Africa.
And so if you're, you know, you describe these kind of romantic notions or essentialist notions that are a guiding vision, combined with left ideas and impulses that are a guiding vision for some of these independent schools, but for people who then go through a transformation and contact with movements and figures in the African continent and bring that back, then what do they do in school?
Right.
How does that affect the schools?
Well, so that's very complex. I mean, so another sort of premise of black progressives, Pan-Africanists, black left at this time is this colonial analogy, right? This notion that black people are not just the victims of discrimination, but they actually are colonized, you know, that the United States ruling class, power structure, government, state is the mother country. Is the colonizer, and that black communities are the colonial possessions of the United States. Amilcar Cabral, who is sort of universally adored, revered, respected by black leftists, makes a couple of visits.
And just say who he is.
He's a revolutionary leader from Guinea-Bissau, one of the sort of last vestiges of colonial rule on the African continent, Portuguese colonialism, comes to the United States, freedom fighter, comes to the United States. He has a meeting in Harlem, packed room, something like, I don't know, 60 black militants from various organizations. And he says, and it basically explodes this analogy.
Yeah.
You know, he says, look, our situations are not identical, right? And he says, rather than calling me brother, he said, if we're members of a family, that's a particular relationship. He said, but it has its limitations. Rather than calling me brother, call me comrade, right? I want to be your comrade, which means for him, and he explained this very much more brilliantly than I'm doing, he said, which means that our struggles are not interchangeable, right? They're interconnected, but they're not interchangeable. And we have to understand the differences as well as the similarities in order to wage our own struggles as effectively as possible, and in order to serve as effective comrades, right, for each other. You doing your part for anti-imperialism here in the belly of the beast, and you know, me doing my part over there in Africa. So so that occasioned a real shift in, for many of these organizers, in terms of rhetoric, in terms of philosophy, and ultimately in terms of the sort of day-to-day tactics of organizing.
Yeah, and say more about what this meant for people building independent schools.
Right. Well, okay, so one of the, in the case of Malcolm X Liberation University, the whole premise of Malcolm X Liberation University
one of the things I should say is there's a real rejection of what you might call Western democratic educational traditions, right? I mean, these organizers sort of reject those, you know, Dewey or whatever, they reject those traditions out of hand. As far as they're concerned, that democratic rhetoric is just a cover for, you know, capitalist accumulation, white supremacy, et cetera. One of the main goals of these schools is actually to recruit a cadre, a class of young, talented African Americans who are going to graduate from these institutions and go to Africa, or to some extent, to a lesser extent, the Caribbean, in order to participate directly in the nation-building projects of emerging post-colonial states. The idea being that the struggle both for liberation in the sort of remaining colonies, but also the struggle to build nations, to build new nations, is the central struggle of the time. It is the sort of central arena for the clash between oppressor and oppressed, between the capitalist world and the socialist third world. And black people in the United States, in order to participate, had to go overseas.
Yeah.
Right. So Malcolm X Liberation University in Durham, well, Durham and then Greensboro, North Carolina, initially is very focused on sending folks overseas. That's the main arena of struggle. Ultimately, they begin to create more of a dialectic, right, between the overseas struggles and the local struggles. So there's a kind of a return to the local.
Mm.
You know, this sort of struggle comes full circle from a very local civil rights movement that has some sort of transnational elements, to a very consciously, you know, overtly internationalist, and then an attempt to sort of marry the two.
Yeah. You know, it makes me think also about, like, just the work that I know many people, if you're an educator and you're at the socialism conference, like, I'm sure you're always trying in whatever space you can to create opportunities for some kind of new ideas to enter in, for radical epiphanies, to open things up politically, introduce people to things they've never heard before, or try to you have similar goals in mind. But we're constrained in so many ways in the spaces that we work in. But what's better, to try to create something from scratch, or to fight over to make more space in the institutions as they presently exist? Answer, which is better?
Well, I mean, I have to say, I feel ashamed calling myself an educator in a room full of people that are, many of you, I'm sure, are doing much more relevant work than I am. I find myself in the very perplexing situation to be working in an Ivy League institution, an elite private institution that really is the belly of the beast in terms of sort of corporate education and the corporatization of education. And nevertheless, I'm struggling, as we all are, to be a radical intellectual and a radical educator, a guerrilla historian, as I like to. On my better days, and thinking about what are the constraints of that, what are the contradictions, and what are the possibilities for transformation within and without the institutions that surround us, you know, and I do not have an answer for that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the answer that haunts me every day. You know, I live in a little town called Ithaca, New York. It is it's a very liberal place. It's very self-congratulatory place. It's a place with a very thin progressive veneer. I was just at last night, late last night. I was at a before I flew early this morning. I was at a town council meeting, and the big issue there is that we've had a racist police brutality incident. And amazing to hear these council members speak out of both sides of their neck. But anyway, that's the sort of environment we're in. And then, of course, we're up on the hill at Cornell. And you know, I mean,
those of you who are in different situations, I think there's a similar paradox in that the institution that sustains you, in which there are, you know, possibilities for some degree of perhaps self-fulfillment in terms of, you know, teaching, etc. But also is also your cage.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, yeah.
So I mean, you know, my students, we were talking about this earlier. My students that actually confront the contradictions of corporate education most viscerally, you know, in a sort of most thorough way, that becomes a massive crisis for them.
Yeah.
And of course, that crisis is generative.
Yeah.
But I'm very aware of my limitations as someone who exists within this creature, to, you know, pedagogically, politically, to sort of cultivate that and take it to the next level. And I think that's when parallel institutions can be, for all of their limitations, which I'm sure we'll talk about in the discussion, can be useful. You know, when I think about this historical moment that we're in now, I really feel like we're in a liminal moment. You know, like nobody really knows what's going to happen next. Clearly, globalization, neoliberalism, whatever you want to call it, clearly that has reached a crisis of such profound proportions. People all over the world are in upheaval. There's deep, deep discontent. But at the same time, there's no clear way forward, and there's no clear successor that's emerging, right? And I've sort of made peace now that I'm, you know, experiencing a middle-aged crisis. I'm at the age where you sort of start thinking about these things. I've sort of made peace with the idea that this may be how much of the rest of my life, this is the moment, this is the kind of political atmosphere that might surround me for years to come. And what valuable contribution can I make in the context of my time, right, to the struggle for transformation? And I think, again, I come back to this question of prefigurative politics. Again, it's not perfect. You know, building independent institutions, the whole ideal of autonomy is not perfect. Mm. But the notion that we can begin to practice, you know, a transition, it doesn't mean that we don't struggle with the mainstream institutions, with the state institutions. It's not a substitute for class struggle. It's not a substitute for trade unionism. But I think that's part of my fascination with this moment in the in the late 60s and early 70s, because it's the idea that we can build the kind of society in miniature that we deserve, that we would like to inhabit.
I think, well, let me push back on it a little bit and say that one of the things I actually got from your book was the regenerative and the importance of struggle, as you just mentioned, for renewing and refreshing and making relevant these semi-autonomous or independent schools. Like, divorced from a project of struggle, they became kind of prefigurative in a way that was like, sclerotic is a word I want to say, like just kind of a dead end. But then once, if they became connected once again to something that was in motion, to people in motion, whether it was on a local level or internationally, then they kind of got a new life and they became relevant again. And I think that's one of the things, going back to that Doxy Wilkerson quote, like, it's the struggle that makes possible these educational experiments more than the educational experiments make possible the struggle, although that's what we're trying to do in so many spaces.
You can't escape the problem of building mass movements. I mean, you know, I don't need to tell this audience that. I mean, that is that's the central problem of our time. And so, again, perhaps it's wrong not only to think of sort of a, you know, autonomous institutions as alternatives. Maybe it's also wrong to think about them as a supplement for our other struggles, because they're deeply interrelated. And if we think about all of these moments that produce in Black history, Black American history, that produce the most vibrant parallel institutions, independent schools, whether it's, you know, Garveyism in the 1920s, whether it's the citizenship schools, whether it's the freedom schools, the liberation schools, the Black Panther liberation schools, right, in the 60s, mm-hmm. late 60s, going into the 70s. There are moments when mass struggle is most vibrant. And in the absence of that, what do you get, for example, over the course of the 1970s, in the midst of the repression and the retrenchment and the sort of demobilization, by the, let's say by the election of Reagan,
yeah,
by the Reagan era, you really get the blossoming of what? Afrocentrism, right? You get this whole proliferation of Afrocentric schools. Mm-hmm. At the same time that you're having this conservative ascendancy. And what is Afrocentrism? And Afrocentrism in many ways is a successor, or it's a, in some ways it's continuing this tradition of insisting on Black self-determination, but it's doing so in a way that is not at all hostile mm-hmm. To monopoly capitalism. Mm-hmm. In fact, it has a kind of entrepreneurial ethos to it. Mm-hmm. And what the right learns, as many of you know very well, is that, hey, you know, we can really have a real rapprochement with bourgeois Black nationalism that's simply about kind of affirming identity and doesn't demand any kind of redistribution, doesn't mm-hmm. have a real mm-hmm. Class critique, is very repressive in terms of gender, etc. So part of the impetus for this book was me coming of age in the 80s and 90s and going to historically Black university and sort of imbibing all of that that neo-Black nationalism and hip-hop, et cetera, but then asking, well, where's the anti-imperialism? Mm. Where's the radical third worldism? Where's the class analysis, right? Where is this sort of revolutionary impulses that had been so central to Black, so certain tendencies of Black nationalism during the height of Black power? And I think that's part of the answer, that there's strains that are more amenable to the ruling class that are sort of lifted up, and the other tendencies are crushed.
Yeah, and maybe that's also goes part way to answering my next question, which is about what happens when we win some of the reforms that we fight for in education and they become almost like co-opted and professionalized. I'm thinking about Black studies or culturally relevant curriculum or restorative justice. Like sometimes people fight and fight and fight to change these paradigms in the schools and then win. And suddenly these become like buzzwords that can almost be like used against you or become stripped of their redistributive potential or their transformative ethos or their movement connections and become like, become co-opted in a way or kind of stripped of their radicalism.
Right. I mean, I'm glad you brought up Black studies. You know, Black studies, of course, going through a number of very important anniversaries. We had the ivory tower, and now in many ways we've got the ebony tower. You know, I think Black studies still has radical possibilities. Black studies was really it was an epistemological shift. It was an ontological shift. It was a transformation in the nature of knowledge, right? So we're not going to accept this Eurocentrism. We're going to create a new language. We're going to create new logics of education. We want education for liberation. And part of the demand for Black studies, we have to remember, it comes out of the late 60s in a moment when the cities are exploding. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the leverage, mm-hmm. right? It's not that, you know, these white guys that are running institutions, you know, got religion all of a sudden. or drop religion for you secularists, but it's not that they got morality, it's that that there was an overwhelming demand and it was backed up by the street.
Yeah.
So part of the rationale, and this was made quite explicit by many Black studies activists, part of the rationale for institutionalizing within institutions, when I say within institutions, both historically white, predominantly white institutions and historically Black institutions, because there was a real argument within Black studies that we should build Black studies outside of the context of any of these traditional institutions, right. That it should really be on the street.
Yeah.
I mean, quite literally in some ways, you know. But part of the rationale was that we are going to use, that this is not only going to be a center for an alternative to Eurocentric learning and pedagogy, but that we're going to use these institutions, these Black Studies centers, to redistribute the incredible resources, you know, of the post-war American university, you know, the multiversity. We're gonna redistribute those resources to the poor Black and brown people that in so many cases occupy the neighborhoods surrounding these, you know, whether you're talking about Yale or, you know, Penn or wherever, that surround these institutions. And that part, of course, didn't happen.
Right.
And it didn't happen because that would have required not only the institutionalization of Black studies, but it would have required the transformation of higher education. I think, to some extent, Black studies transformed higher education, but not in that redistributive sense that would have made a material change in material realities of Black and brown poor folks.
And that brings us back to the Black movement in education as a movement that has, at its height, aspired in various moments not just to assimilate to American society as it is, but to transform it, to transform school and to transform society.